time once again for Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Lara Zarowski, Anna Tolan, and Ari Cohn. Lara Zarowski serves as the Policy Director for the Innocence Project Northwest and as a law lecturer at the University of Washington School of Law, where she founded and teaches the Innocence Project Northwest Legislative Advocacy Clinic. She has worked in the criminal justice field since 2001, when she began working in Seattle Municipal Court's Mental Health Court. She began her career in the Washington State Legislature, where she served as nonpartisan staff to the House Judiciary and Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness Committees. Anna Tolan is the past president of the Washington Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. She has 20 years of criminal defense experience in private practice in Seattle and as a public defender in Mount Vernon and at the Federal Public Defender for the Western District of Washington. Prior to joining IPNW as a supervising attorney, she was an IPNW supporter and frequent volunteer attorney. And Ari Cohn, who has been on the show before, is the founder, president, and managing director of the Post-Prison Education Program. Lara, Anna, and Ari, thank you all three for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike, for having us. Let me just say that Don Varentis is the managing director. I'm the president and whatever, but and guy that does the dishes, but Don's right, the managing director.
Gotcha. Sorry about that. All right, let's start out, Lara and Anna, tell us what is the Innocence Project Northwest and how did it come about?
Sure. So Innocence Project Northwest started as a volunteer attorney organization in 1997 and was organized to address the cases that have become known since then as the Wenatchee sex ring cases that happened in Wenatchee, Washington. There were many thousands of allegations of child sex abuse and satanic ritual and that sort of thing that that I think implicated 29 or 30 defendants. And there were many convictions and kind of a lot of wreckage from that case. And a lot of attorneys were recognizing that something needed to be done. So our founder and director, Jacqueline McMurtry, at the time began organizing groups of attorneys. And Anna Tolan was actually one of those volunteer attorneys back in the 90s. To help get relief for some of these people. And ultimately, every person who was imprisoned was released by the year 2000. And some people ended up with civil judgments, and some people ended up pleading to lesser crimes just to kind of resolve the case. But it was kind of widely agreed that it was sort of a tragedy that happened in Wenatchee. And so that was how the organization got started, and then remained a volunteer attorney organization until about 2002. And we're housed at the University of Washington School of Law. And so at that time, we became a clinical law program. So every year, about anywhere from 10 to 20 students enroll in the clinic and are able to work with supervising attorneys to litigate these cases of actual innocence, do motions for DNA, post-conviction DNA testing, and that sort of thing. So we take only Washington State cases, and we have some basic criteria that people have to meet in order to be accepted or considered for assistance. We have far more requests for assistance than we're able to address, but we've recently grown in the last couple of years. We now have, Anna's our deputy director. I'm the policy director, so I kind of open up the policy shop. I don't work on cases, but working on policy reform to kind of try to prevent wrongful convictions in our state going forward. We also have Fernanda Torres, who's our staff attorney and a paralegal, Laura Fox, and recently an administrative position. So we're kind of slowly growing, but the last few years have been the first time we've actually had this sort of resources.
And don't forget Peter Marino.
And Peter Marino. <who's>
just joined us from the Wisconsin Innocence Project.
That's right.
Yeah, we're really happy to have more help on our cases.
So give us a sense for the criteria. How do you select the cases that you end up focusing on?
Sure. So we're part of what's called the Innocence Network. So there's a lot of confusion right out of the gate about whether we are part of the Innocence Project. That's the national litigation organization based out of New York City that was started by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld in 1996, I believe. We're actually the third project. We're all of the Innocence Projects across the world now are actually independent, but we're all affiliated in what's called the Innocence Network. So we share information, we do conferences together and that sort of thing. But each project is independent. So some projects do only DNA cases that can be resolved through the use of post-conviction DNA testing. Other projects will take on any kind of case. And we are one of those projects that does both. So Anna here works exclusively on DNA cases. And our staff attorney, Fernanda Torres, works on both, and Peter Marino, I believe, works on both
yes.
as well. So our basic criteria is that the person has to have been convicted in a Washington state court and serving time in Washington. Our name, Northwest, is a little bit misleading, but at the time that we were started, we really thought that we'd be able to cover a lot more than just Washington state. But back in the 90s, all of us were underestimating the problem of wrongful convictions. So they have to have at least a few years left on their sentence. Because these cases take a long time to resolve, so that's been one of our criteria. And they have to claim actual innocence, have maintained their actual innocence of the crime for which they were convicted. And there has to be some sort of new evidence that we can use to challenge the conviction. So some sort of evidence that was not available at the time of the trial that we might be able to use to get back into court to try to establish their actual innocence. So I think, does that cover it?
And then we don't take cases until after direct appeal. So our work comes in after your right to counsel has expired and you've exhausted all of your appeals after trial, and we're there to look at cases that the system has believed to be finished and see if there's something we can go back to correct and look at. So
the new evidence, is that a legal requirement to be able to reopen a case?
It is, yeah. Once you're in the post-conviction world, and once that last appeal is final, it becomes extremely difficult to open up a case again and try to relitigate some of these. A lot of issues that have been litigated, you can't go back and revisit those issues if they've already been decided by a court. So you have a very narrow basis on which you can get back into court to try to do that. One of those ways is we have a law. Now all 50 states have a law for post-conviction DNA testing. So if there's biological evidence collected in your case that might be able to establish your actual innocence on a more probable than not basis, then that can be the basis for an appeal to get back into court. So that's just an example. Another would be recanted testimony of someone who testified against you at trial that later recants and says that, no, that wasn't right, and here's why I said that. Those tend to be much more difficult, especially if there appears to be an incentive to, to be deviating from your story, but there are other ways.
And is recanted testimony, is that something generally the people that are bringing the case to you come forward with and let you know about, or is that something you find through investigation? Or?
Both. I think both have happened. Sometimes people have asked us to look into their cases, and there has been other issues that would suggest to us there might be a real problem here, and we've begun an investigation and found new testimony, new information. Other times people will write to us and say, this was a wrongful conviction, I'm innocent, and please contact this person. They've reached out to me, or I've heard from someone else that they're willing to tell the truth now.
And do you have enough resources to cover all the cases you would like to cover? Do you have to turn any away that you feel are legitimate, yet you don't have the resources to cover?
We of course, don't have enough resources. We get anywhere from 20 to 40 requests for assistance every month. We have a backlog that we try diligently to get through, but there's not enough time and resources and people in the project to do all the work that's out there. So it's always a challenge. We are always seeking funding from private donors, grants, and we've been really fortunate lately to be able to grow and have the increase to the five attorneys that are on staff now, and that growth has resulted in really a lot of great results in the last couple of years. We had 4 exonerations last year. Laura's clinic passed a bill for compensation. So with that growth, with that infusion of resources, we see the results, but we're still struggling to meet the demand.
And any government funding at all for this to correct the wrongs?
Yes, actually my position is funded by a federal grant that was brought about based on the exoneration of Kirk Bloodsworth, who was the first death row exoneree out of Maryland. And so there's a pool of federal funding that supports programs like ours, both doing DNA cases and non-DNA cases. But those funds are limited. There's a lot of competition for them now. We've been fortunate to receive some of those grants. And, of course, as we all know, with federal funding, that can be a challenging way to rely on your existence. So we're certainly looking for other resources at all times. Yeah.
Mike, it's one thing that's really important instead of approaching this analytically, I think, is to think in terms of it emotionally from the standpoint of somebody who's wrongfully accused. So if you walked out of here today, or anybody that's listening walks out of wherever they're at today, and you get arrested for something that you absolutely, unequivocally didn't do, and then you're in a jail, and then you're in a prison, and you're there for years, It's really important to people for people to know that that happens, and there's basically been no help for the people in that situation for forever until the Innocence Project came along. So if listeners will make this personal, I think they can better relate to the issue. I mean, it's I can't even imagine. I can't imagine being in prison or on a death row for something that I didn't do. And in some cases, people are in that situation after suffering the loss of somebody in their family, a near family member, loved one, and you're accused of their death. So you suffer that loss, and then you lose your freedom, and then you're gone for 10 years, 20 years, and so on. So it's just really incredible, important, I think, to just make it personal and look at it on an emotional level.
Maybe you guys could talk about some specific cases, perhaps some of the last four from this year, successful cases.
Sure. Do you want to start with the Statler case? So we had four individuals. Actually, all of those cases were from Spokane County. Last year, there were three young men who were accused of assault and robbery. And their convictions were based on an informant who was later determined to be unreliable, and also their convictions were based on ineffective counsel. So there's often in our cases lots of, you know, different aspects of what contributes to the problem. But these four young men were facing lengthy prison sentences, and in that situation, they had written to us, and Dwayne Statler, the father of Paul Statler, one of the exonerees, was just an ardent champion. His son, as Ari said, when you have a family member in prison, his son was in prison for something he didn't do, and he wanted to get him help. And so ultimately our project got involved, got attorneys who volunteered to work with the other two defendants, and it became an effort to try to investigate and present evidence to the court to free those men. And it's about a year ago, right before Christmas, that they were granted a new trial, and the court actually did ask them to be, you know, order them to be released from prison. They weren't actually exonerated till later, this year, after the case went through the system and the prosecutor ultimately decided not to pursue a new trial. And so that process took quite some time. And so having those three young men out and free and finally being able to start their lives again, The other client from Spokane County, Jeremy Davis, was convicted of a murder, and the true perpetrator was ultimately identified through DNA, prosecuted, and convicted. And the prosecutor in that case was resisting for quite some time releasing our client. New trial was granted, and after a lot of litigation and investigation, and the state's attempts to use an informant to suggest that there was a link between him and this other perpetrator that ultimately couldn't be proved, he was also released and reunited with his family this past spring. So, you know, the opportunity to watch these men walk out of prison and be able to, you know, meet their children, hug their parents is just, it's so rewarding and so compelling.
Yeah, and if I could just jump into, you know, in the cases of wrongful conviction that have been identified across the country, not just in our state, but I mean, just to give a sense of the scope of the problem. You know, DNA exonerations, the last time I checked a couple of days ago, I think it's a 311 DNA exonerations across the country. But if you take into account non-DNA exonerations as well, and the cases that Anna just described from our clinic that involved informants, or as they're sometimes colloquially referred as snitches, I mean, those cases, if you include those and all the other non-DNA exoneration cases, we're talking about over 1,200 cases nationally that have been identified just since 1989. So that's kind of the benchmark that tends to be used, because 1989 was the first year that a person was exonerated in an American courtroom using DNA. So since then, over 1,200 cases have been identified with very strict criteria, and there's actually a very useful resource called the National Registry of Exonerations that Professor Samuel Gross has put together from the University of Michigan, so anybody can access it, and you can search it and find the causes and that sort of thing. But, you know, the issue of informants being a contributing factor to wrongful convictions. It's a significant number, somewhere between 16% and 18% of the DNA exonerations involved an informant giving the primary evidence against the person. And notably, when you take into account just death penalty cases, an informant is the primary cause of wrongful conviction in death cases. So in almost half of the exonerations from death row that we've seen, and there have been 142 exonerations from death row on any basis, not just DNA, and of those 142, nearly half of them, the cause of the wrongful conviction was the use of an informant. And, you know, it's just, I think that we have to, it can be kind of confusing about what an informant is. I mean, there are people who inform in a courtroom all the time, of course, any kind of witness to a crime, anyone, you know, a whistleblower, someone who is a witness to something, those are all, they all give testimony that implicates another person. But there's a kind of a different category of people when we refer to them as a snitch or a paid informant, an incentivized witness, is someone who is getting something in exchange for their testimony. And in the case of Paul Statler, our client that was exonerated or released about a year ago, he and his two co-defendants, you know, the person who testified against them in their case, it was the only evidence against them, was the testimony of this person who received a deal. He would have been facing about 40 years in prison for his own crimes. And in exchange for his testimony, he ended up getting 18 months in a juvenile facility. So to say that he would not have, that he had an incentive to fabricate the evidence against them would be a gross understatement. There's clear motivation for him to protect the people who actually committed the crime and to implicate other people. And that's the kind of deal we're talking, when we're saying incentive, we don't just mean that maybe they'll give him a little bit of leniency. In this case, it was a difference between 18 months in a juvenile facility and 40 years in prison.
Well, and sometimes it can be you just don't get prosecuted at all. I mean, you become a paid informant, and the cases or the charges you're facing just aren't brought against you, period. And somebody else, whoever you give up to save your own derriere, to be polite, they face the music and they face the prosecution. So sometimes snitches give somebody else up to just completely remove themselves from the prosecution picture.
So should we question the whole validity of informants then?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a criminal justice system that relies so heavily on informants. I mean, I practiced in the federal system for a while, and in federal court, especially in drug cases, almost every case that the government has is built on informants. It's a race to the door when there has been any sort of a bust that happens, where who can get in and cooperate first, because the consequences are so grave that people are put in very challenging positions. But it's accepted. I mean, it's an accepted process by the courts, by the prosecutors and police, and maybe there's effective ways to do it, but what we see is where it's broken. We see where people are giving false testimony, untruthful testimony, and backed by the state. I mean, we've seen cases where the prosecution is basically questioning a victim's testimony because they want to rely on their unreliable informant who's giving false testimony. So it's remarkable what can happen.
And just to add what Anna just said about the federal system, I mean, I think it's really notable. I mean, probably the reason that there's this rush to the door to see who can inform first, what a lot of people don't know, and frankly I didn't know until about a year ago when I started looking into this, is that the only exception to the federal mandatory minimums in drug cases is to provide quote-unquote substantial assistance to the government in other cases, which means if you become an informant, it is your only way out from underneath a federal mandatory minimum on drug cases, which we all know are sort of, you know, there's been much criticism about whether they're appropriate as it is in terms of the length of incarceration for some of these crimes. And that is the only way out, to inform. So there's really an institutional incentive built into the very fabric of the federal system. And, you know, in the FBI actually has an entire handbook about how to develop and handle your quote-unquote CI, your confidential informant. And there are a lot of rules that go along with that, a lot of documentation. In the local governments, not to say it's a good thing because it's been documented, there still are problems with it. But on the local system, one of the hallmarks of the informant system is it's very difficult to know the extent that it's being used, how it's being used, because so much of it escapes notice, goes undocumented. As Ari was saying, sometimes the deal is kind of off the record where they'll say, well, we just won't make a paper trail. We won't even charge you with this if you do X, Y, and Z. And those parts of the cases are extremely difficult to understand. And, you know, when you get someone who's been accused of something, of a crime by an informant, you know, the defense under our system has the right to have information about, you know, the credibility and reliability of those witnesses that are being put forward. If there's never a record being made of that deal, it's impossible to have the proper information to adequately cross-examine that person on the stand. And so it really kind of undermines a lot of our entire criminal justice system to use this when it's not really out in the open.
You know, Mike, last year the Innocence Project Northwest had a annual dinner, and they had how many exonerees at that dinner?
We had probably 8 exonerees.
It was absolutely emotional and amazing to be in this room with 100, 200, I don't know how many people. There was a packed dining room, and Jackie McMurtry had these exonerees stand up, and to real people with real families and real hopes and dreams that have done time for crimes they didn't commit, and to be there in the room, it was pretty amazing. It was really, it was cool.
I want you to get back to another story or two. We only got about 7 minutes left. But in addition to these informants that are bringing forth questionable evidence, how much of this do we lay on prosecutors that must have a sense that, you know, they're basically creating this stuff out of thin air?
Well, that's, you know, that I think you'd have to look at each one on a case-by-case basis. I've heard a lot of, you know, in January of last year, and in the Senate Law and Justice Committee, there was a work session. So anybody who wants to see this, you can go to tvw.org and look at their media archives, and you can see there's recordings of all these things. So anybody who's interested in that. And it was about this issue specifically, and the reason was that our client, Paul Statler, is from the jurisdiction where the chair of that committee is, so he's from Spokane. And then, so that legislator has kind of generated an interest in how to deal with this. And, you know, the testimony of the prosecutors during that work session was, you know, oh, boy, we lose sleep at night, too, about whether these people are telling the truth. You know, but they say, you know, this is critical and this is important. We need to have informants. If we can't use informants, we can't go forward on all these cases. So that's kind of, you know, the jury's out on that one, no pun intended. But a couple of jurisdictions have made an attempt to regulate the use of informants to try to at least ensure greater reliability. Texas and Illinois, and I believe there's, and California actually have all passed legislation that requires some sort of corroboration that the person accused by the informant was actually the person who committed the crime, or they conduct some sort of reliability hearing so the judge pretrial can listen to the testimony that the informant is going to give and make a determination of whether or not that testimony is reliable enough to go to the jury. So there have been a couple of efforts legislatively across the country, not very many, and all of them are sort of imperfect. I mean, even if you have a reliability hearing, who's to say that that's really going to identify, but it's at least something. And there was a bill in the state legislature a few years ago that would do exactly this, to try to institute reliability hearings. And at least as a first step, I would submit that's probably a great place to start if we're going to be using informants in the system, and to frankly never let a prosecution go forward if the only evidence against a defendant is the testimony of an incentivized witness. It's inherently unreliable, and I think that's something we can all recognize.
And it's really great to have Laura be able to do the policy work she's doing, because that allows correction of these problems on the front end, trying to fix the system at its, you know, at its initial operation level in the trial courts so that we don't have these convictions. I think what listeners really need to understand is how hard it is and how much time it takes for those who are wrongly convicted to undo a wrongful conviction once it's been done. You know, a few of our exonerees, Larry Davis and Alan Northrup, spent 17 years in prison for a rape that they did not commit. Ted Bradford spent nearly a decade in prison for a rape he didn't commit. And those cases came to our attention and were, you know, brought forward in the system, but it took years to be able to get the results that were needed to undo that wrong and get them back home and free. And the lives that were lost for them are just, you can't put that back together.
And I have to imagine, even if you are overturned, if this is overturned and you guys get them out, that they still are facing this public opinion that, you know, of doubt.
Well, to be honest, the public, I'm sure that they've encountered that. The public response tends to be more positive. The problem is that in none of our cases have the prosecutors acknowledged that there's a wrongful conviction, even when there's DNA indicating that the actual perpetrator were other people. So that's a real problem. In some jurisdictions, you know, the prosecutors have stepped forward, at least accepted that a mistake was made and kind of owned that. And it universally in our cases, I don't think we've had one prosecutor's office that's accepted.
None of our clients have ever received an apology from the people that prosecuted them.
And sometimes local law enforcement is horrible. If Anna and Laura want to name somebody by name, but I'm thinking of Yakima. So the law enforcement entity that made the wrongful conviction, that brought the whole conviction and brought the person into the courtroom, they just never accept that they were wrong, and they act accordingly and can be really horrible, to put it nicely.
So how do we fix that? If the prosecutors don't acknowledge that there was anything wrong, does the state acknowledge anything was wrong with these cases?
Well, since this year, just in 2013, we were able to pass the bill to compensate the wrongly convicted. So there's now a statute in place that allows people to seek compensation if they can establish by documentary evidence that they were actually innocent. It's a high standard. It's not going to be easy, but in the clearest cases, those who are actually innocent and were exonerated should be able to go in and do that. And by successfully pursuing one of those cases, you would get an acknowledgement that you're actually innocent through the course of being awarded compensation for your wrongful conviction. So it's sort of an implicit acknowledgement that, yes, you were in this position. But other than that, there are no other mechanisms under the law really to acknowledge these, to differentiate these exonerations from anyone else who has their conviction overturned for any other reason. So there's really no delineation under the law, except to the extent that those who apply for compensation would have that little bit of extra acknowledgement, I guess, through the court system.
You know, Mike, if people want to know more about this than this program allows from a time point, they can go to CBS News or Google 48 Hours Secrets of the River and just watch that show that they'll get, 48 Hours Secrets of the River, and they can see how this plays out. And it's pretty horrible. I can't imagine being accused of something that I didn't do, let alone having that lead to a prison sentence. But that's a great CBS News report and well worth everybody's watching or time if they want to take the time to look at it.
Right. We're just about out of time. We're talking with Laura Zurowski and Anna Tolan, both with the Innocence Project Northwest, and Ari Cohn with the Post-Prison Education Program. How can people find out more about the Innocence Project Northwest? Do you guys have a webpage?
We do. It's www.ipnw.org. If you Google Innocence Project Northwest, we come up. We are on Facebook as well. So we'd love people to look at our site and see what we've been up to. The stories of our exonerees are there, and there's more information available.
And if they want to support you,
if they would like to donate, we would love that. And there is a donate button on our website. We appreciate all support for the work we're doing.
All right. And Ari, your organization?
Postprisonedu.org. Also, we're on Facebook. You can just search Post-Prison Education Program, or you can Google Post-Prison Education Program. We've got a fairly high internet presence at this point, I think. So, or we're downtown Seattle, 810 3rd Avenue in the Central Building, and we welcome visitors.
All right. All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank all three of you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.